Welcome to The Bookshelf, and welcome back to The Desk on the Sea, written and read by Jonathan Johnson. In tonight's episode, Mary Poppins, Hogwarts, and plenty of magic await.
Amy, Anya, and I were on a hidden pebble beach in Crail, beneath a garden that terraced down steeply from a stone house. Pebbles rattled in the waves' backwash, while Anya hopped back and forth between a pair of boulders the waves reached up to encircle. As usual, we were in a play of her invention. Amy was the BBC camera person, I was the sports reporter, and Anya was the athlete attempting to complete a successful rock hop in the new Olympic event by that name. After a few practice hops, she was ready. "She's really trained up for this," I opined. "But I don't know. This is a record-breaking hop she's attempting today. Okay, here we go. A confident climb." Anya scurried back onto the first boulder and crouched like a frog aiming at the second boulder while suppressing all but the faintest smile. "Okay, Daddy, now say she's gonna go for it." "She's going for it, folks," I said in a hushed voice as Amy panned her imaginary camera from me to Anya. "World record attempt." She leaped. "And she's done it! She's done it, ladies and gentlemen. That's a new world record. Let's see if we can get a word with her. Anya! Anya, over here!" "Hiya!" The three of us looked up. Debbie Stamper was standing at the bottom of her garden and trying not to grin. At her side, however, her 10-year-old son Callum showed no risk of grinning. He was the picture of restraint, for which I was grateful. No big deal for Anya if an adult was amused at our little play. Such amusement by one of her schoolmates would have been quite another matter, though. Right then and there, dark and curly-headed, full and freckle-cheeked Callum made my list of favorite people in Crail. And Debbie made the list almost as quickly, with her own freckles and her red hair, smile, long blouse in the sea wind, and her invitation to come up for a glass of wine. We'd met and exchanged pleasantries before. She and her husband Alan are the official goodwill ambassadors and chief enthusiasts for Crail Harbor. Together they run a little cafe, the Crail Harbor Tea Room, adjacent to their home. And Debbie is an artist whose paintings of this coast hang in cottages all over the village. Now, as she poured the wine and tucked her feet up onto the couch up under her, she told us she was glad to have us just down the shore and sorry it had taken so long to have us over. She was eager to know if we were happy here. Delighted, we all agreed. Alan soon joined us from the tea room kitchen where he'd been repairing the espresso machine. He's maybe 10 years older than Debbie, retired from technical and engineering business, and appeared the casual British gentleman in his shorts and Madras plaid shirt sleeves. His friendliness was couched in pragmatic conversation, how Anya was finding school, how we liked the car we'd purchased, where we planned a visit in Scotland, but was no less sincere than Debbie's enthusiasm. It's been good, Amy, Anya, and I settling into our new life together, just the three of us, snug in a cottage on a windswept sea, with an abundance of time and attention for one another. But since Anya started school, Amy's been missing our circle of friends back home. Anya, too, has admitted to being a little lonely. Of the three of us, I am by far the most at home in isolation. Solitude is where my poetry resides and where I go to grieve. But even I am ready for a community again. Though it was our first time in the Stamper's living room, it already felt comfortable, familiar. And so did they, like friends already. Anya and Callum went up to his room for some computer games. Alan opened a second bottle of wine as the breeze came in through the door, opened to a horizon of sea. Back in August, when Amy and I heard an advertisement on the radio for a production of Mary Poppins at the Edinburgh Playhouse, we decided the musical would be the perfect outing when Amy's parents came for a visit in October. But as the date of their visit drew closer, I alternated between pleasantly anticipating and fearing the show. Yes, fearing Mary Poppins. I've known every word of every song by heart since I was a small boy and can right now, with virtually no effort, conjure in my mind my mother's voice singing supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. What's more, Mary Poppins' blend of spit-spot orderliness, taken with a bit of pride to satiric extremes, along with propriety, whimsy, and kindness, was for my mother a kind of playful model for how she saw herself caring for her family. This aspect of my mother's personality and self-concept had its serious origins in her proper Scottish nana, maintaining a sense of safety and care as both parents spun themselves into alcoholic chaos and self-destruction. But my mother also knew how to enjoy who she was and cultivated the Mary Poppins in herself with great pleasure. In every job that must be done, there's an element of fun. My sister and I understood our roles as the children being taught our good manners and compassion and sing-along optimism. Nowhere is there a more happier crew than them that sings Chim Chimini Chim Chim Chiroo. But how was I going to sit there, hearing these silly songs, watching Mary Poppins teach Michael and Jane good manners and compassion and sing-along optimism, without losing it? Would a resentment rise up in me at Amy's folks, healthy, middle-class grandparents on the go, taking in a musical in Europe with the three of us, as I sat there, knowing that my mom, whose health was too far gone by the time such middle-class possibilities were within her financial reach, would have counted the same night as among the happiest imaginable if she had been able to join us? I could see myself weeping like an idiot, there in the audience of kids and parents and grandparents, as Mary Poppins drifted down from the sky, umbrella in hand. And, sure enough, last night when we went to the show, I did shed a tear or two. My mother had said many times that if she could have been granted any ability, it would have been to sing and dance. And there were all these dancers, singing and turning and spinning Mary Poppins from chimney to chimney on the rooftops, their brushes twirling with their lithe bodies in silhouette. How many innumerable brain cells branching innumerably to brain cells make up a human being? What divine mathematics of those cells stored and sung supercalifragilisticexpialidocious and happily kept on imagining dancing across that stage long after the feet were gone? I sat there with the reality that all those cells, all of them, and their branches full of this music and movement had crumbled and then turned to ash and to smoke that billowed and curled and became nothing of music or dance or the love of caring for a family, of caring for me. But in the second act, when Mary Poppins returned, flying in again under her umbrella, Anya, exhausted at the end of a big day, was curled in her fancy dress into the crook of my arm, watching all this, writing it in her own innumerable brain cells. Instead of resentment for Amy's folks, I thought of how my mom had been happy to share with them the love of my own little family of three, how she is linked forever with Anya's other grandparents in that one 8-year-old person who was curled on her velvet seat and leaning against me. I thought of how my mom counts on Amy's parents and on my father to go on as her little sprite's grandparents, how she counts on me to teach Anya manners and compassion and sing-along optimism. I admit it, I'm a mama's boy, moved by a schmaltzy musical and how it speaks to me of what I want to be to my sleepy little girl, smiling and watching and cuddled in my arm. So be it. Those beautiful branching cells of my mother's mind that sung and imagined dancing and loved us have dissolved into nothing. I'll have to live the rest of my life knowing that, knowing that's what life will come to for us as well. But I refuse to let my mother's sense of joy dissolve to nothing at all. A spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. We don't have the money to be staying in this old mansion of a Highland hotel with its oak wainscoted lobby, lilies, wood crackling in the fireplace, candles burning in silver candelabras and paintings and stag heads on walls to the 15-foot ceilings. But when I was cottage hunting in May and came to Loch Shield and saw the place, the Glenfinnan House Hotel, the only dwelling as far as I could see on the shore, I told myself I'd bring Amy and Anya, and when they visited us, as they promised they would, Amy's parents here. The place is a bit of a fairy tale on the loch we've seen time and again as the Black Loch in Harry Potter films and imagined beside Hogwarts in 1,000 bedtime stories. We don't have the money, and I mean that literally, but we'll let the good people of MasterCard worry about it, for a while at least. Well, like many writers I know, I pretend myself and family into a luxury beyond my means. Amy and Anya are under the covers and duvet up in the antique bed in our room. Amy's folks are asleep down the hall. None of the rooms has a TV, phone, or, unless you ask for one, which there seems no reason to, a door key. A few minutes ago, I walked out in the dark across the lawn to the dark shore and looked back at the hotel, mountains soaring into the stars around it. A minor vision was fulfilled. Earlier today, we walked to the high, curving train viaduct we'd seen in every Harry Potter movie. Anya and I stood next to the bottom of one of the pillars, and she said, "Let's touch it together on three. 1, 2, 3. I touched the pillar, and she pulled her hand back. "I can't." Ah, the membrane between dream and reality. She knows better than her old dad that it's not always wise to reach through it. She tried again, but her fingertips stopped less than an inch from the concrete. "Oh, I can't do it," she said, as she wheeled back to look at me and rested her back against the pillar. I grinned. "Anya, you're back." "Ooh!" she startled forward. She turned around to face the pillar and stared at it intently. With only a little hesitation now, she reached out and touched it with her hand. Later, on the shore of the loch, I confessed that I couldn't see Hogwarts Castle out on the peninsula where it's supposed to be. "I can," she said. "I'm not surprised. I'm just a muggle. But I'm magic." It was half question and half statement. "So you are." Back at the hotel, she played board games with her mom and grandparents in the library. Meanwhile, I ran 10 miles of a gated dirt track road down the east side of the loch. It was among the best runs of my life. The mountains sloped with orange grasses and brown ferns up to the snow straight above me. Whitecaps rose from the blue loch. Loch Sheel. Sheila. A conversation between rain and sleet and tilting in sun went on all around me. As I ran past that peninsula, onto which someone at a computer screen had superimposed a castle, I admit I looked hard. Rain splattered my glasses, so I took them off to keep from stumbling on the rough road. But the sleet came up again and stung my eyes and then my closed eyelids. I ran on with my hand shielding my eyes until the sun returned. When I turned to look at the storm passing behind me, I saw I was standing before a perfect rainbow, arching from the loch up over the dirt road and back down onto the slope. The intangible. Nothing. Yet here, just the same. The friendship between three young wizards. The memory of our beloved dead. Love itself. The lobby fire before which I've been sitting in a wingback chair and writing this has settled down to embers. The third pint I've billed to our room, after an intermission of one pot of tea, is gone. Amy's folks would have paid for our stay here without giving it a second thought. But this is my vision, my gift, the Highlands. A stately old manor house beside my mother's namesake loch. Like something from a story I've made up for all of them, for myself, in this landscape so welcoming of stories. Halloween, and October ends cold. Amy's folks are gone, back in Michigan. It's just the three of us again. While Anya was in school, Amy and I spent a day searching the secondhand shops in St. Andrews for clothes to go with a fox mask and tail Anya found down in Edinburgh for a costume. Foxes inhabit a significant territory in her psyche. Wolves, cheetahs, and horses hold their own places, too, but it's a fox into which she wants me to turn Harry Potter in our bedtime stories. Always a fox. And she's never wavered on her costume choice for this year. On Amy's parents' last night with us, she wore the mask as we all played poker at the kitchen table. Kids are Amy's great purpose and talent. For work back home, she defends and protects them. She struggles to help their families be kind and caring and safe. She devotes her imagination to empathizing with them. Not infrequently, she cries for them. And their little joys are among her greatest delights. Always, it's the little person's point of view through which Amy sees. And of course, all of this purpose and talent and empathy for kids she devotes also, and above all, to Anya. So Anya's Halloween costume, a chance for the simple happiness of a kid, may well have meant just as much to Amy. She and I made a date out of our search, stopping for lunch before hunting through more secondhand stores in St. Andrew's narrow side streets. Finally, Amy found a brown fleece sweatsuit, a brown fake fur jacket, and a fake fur hat that looked as though it were supposed to be a fox. Later, when Anya tried on the sweats and jacket, she was pleased with the results. The hat, however, looked like a blow-dried fox head puffing out around the mask. The sweatsuit's hood clearly made a more realistic head. Trick-or-treating itself, guising, as it's called here, was a bit like Anya had known it back home. The key difference is that the guisers are required to provide some sort of entertainment, a joke, riddle, song, poem, etc., in exchange for the treat. We were joined by Anya's new friend from school, Emma, who was dressed as a witch, and Emma's mother. As we headed out into the dark, the little fox and little witch ran ahead of us. I explained to Emma's mom that in the U.S., trick-or-treating is a much more straightforward transaction, a more or less empty threat, followed by the passing of candy, followed by a thank you, and you're on to the next door. Sometimes there's a pause in the process, I said, to identify your costume or receive a compliment, but on the whole, the endeavor is one of American mass-scale efficiency. Rain moved in from the sea. I quickened my pace to try to shelter the girls under my umbrella as we passed the small sheep pasture in the middle of the village. The sheep seemed only slightly disturbed by our passing, even if one of us was a fox, and I saw behind us they went right back to grazing in the rain. Emma's mum directed us through the 400-year-old cemetery. As we walked between headstones, she told us for a good fright we had to turn off our torches, which struck me as a much better word than flashlights, especially in this situation. We called at the Gothic stone house of the church vicar, a delightfully jolly bald fellow whom everyone in the village addresses simply as Mike, and who teaches the school's religious education lessons, a regular offering in all state schools in Scotland. Mike had introduced himself to me back in May when I'd come to Crail alone, looking for a place to settle for the year. His eager, kind welcome had contributed to my good feelings about the village. And in the few times I've bumped into him around town since, he's always been anxious to hear how we're getting on, and pleased when I tell him we're delighted to be here. He never says a word to us about coming to his church, and according to Anya, his religious education lessons are about Buddhism and Islam and science as well as Christian principles, all of which he presents with equal enthusiasm. He answered the door in a tall, purple, silver-starred wizard hat, prompting me to wonder how many small-town ministers in the U.S. would dream of wearing that. He invited us inside, and the girls told their jokes. Emma's was, "Em, what do skeletons say when they eat? Bon appetit." She's a shy girl and told it quietly, but with an irresistible brogue and smile beneath her witch hat. Anya's was, "What did the mama ghost say to the baby ghost? Put on your booze and socks." Owing to some combination of Anya's American accent and the thinness of the pun, the joke took a few moments for Mike to get. "Ah, oh yes, boots and socks, of course, brilliant, brilliant." He chuckled heartily and was equally generous with the candy bowl, inviting the girls to take 3 pieces each. The rain passed on, and we made our way through the village, stopping at friends of Emma's family and new friends of ours. We walked under amber streetlights from door to door, down narrow streets of wet stone houses and cottages, Anya yipping and Emma cackling. Between the time it took the girls to repeat their jokes and their parents to have a chat with the hosts at each stop, Anya managed just a fraction of the candy she'd have gotten in the States, but she only seemed to mind a little. Back at our cottage, she sat on the living room floor, fox mask up on her head, and chose a couple pieces before going to bed. Amy asked if we could see her in the mask just once more. Anya obliged and pulled it down over her face, rose on all fours, looked our way, and tilted her head as if to say, "What sort of creatures are you?" Pocket Journal Entry. Marquette, Day 2 continues, February 3rd. I washed soiled bedclothes and towels in the laundry basin in the basement, my hands wrist-deep in hot, sudsy water. Disbelieving, but real. Real like changing her dress, her pain, her naked soft body. But today was also a day of being alive, of feeding her Cheerios, and of her smile when I asked how she liked them. A smile when I told her about Anya's dance classes and how she's going to be here tomorrow and want to climb up in her lap. And lots of smiles as my sister's girlfriends showed up to visit. Kathy said, "Hi, Sheila." Kathy is an Upper Michigan country girl with little in the ways of born material advantages like money or a lithe body. That and her good cheer, her kindness and generosity of spirit, and her decades-long loyalty to my sister have won my mother's love. The unsung and uncelebrated. How it is to be them, to live in their skin. Their humanity has been one of my mother's greatest concerns and joys as long as I can remember. She opened her eyes and smiled and said, "Hi, Kathy." A short time later, Debbie, another of Anne's friends, showed up. Debbie's wedding was in the midst of Mom's last strong time, October, and Mom was thrilled to be well enough to go. She has always believed in Deb. A few years ago, she spent many hours over a period of months talking with her, helping her decide what she wanted to do since she'd graduated with a teaching certificate, only to discover she wasn't passionate about being in the classroom. Mom encouraged Deb in her love of outdoors work. Plenty of people make their livings doing what they love, Mom insisted. Why not Deb? And helping her research degrees in forestry and fill out the applications and loan paperwork. As Deb stepped into the living room, she hugged my sister and Kathy, then bent down and hugged my mom and reported that she'd just been out snowshoeing for 3 hours at work today. "The snow coming down was so beautiful," she said, "and I thought, I'm here because of Sheila." Mom ate spoonfuls of ice cream as Anne fed them to her, and these wonderful young women talked and laughed. Just as she adores them as individuals, Mom has always loved Anne's circle of friends, loved the energy and humor, the camaraderie and goodwill of the young women in my sister's life. And she was part of that, smiling with them through closed eyes, raising her head for a bit, then letting her chin fall to her chest. She growled when offered anything, protein drink, root beer, Sierra Mist, other than ice cream. Her shoulders shook with laughter when Anne said, "You're growling for no, you're smiling for yes?" Finally, it was time for the night duty hospice nurse to help us get Mom in bed, and Anne and her friends left for dinner out on the town. I whispered in Mom's ear, "That made her happy. That was nice, Mom. Good job." Once we had her in bed, but before the uncomfortable change to nightgown, even the slightest movement or brush of her hands pained her, and before the change of dressings on her bed sores, we offered her morphine from a mouth dropper. "Open your mouth if you can," I said. I stroked her cheek, touched her lips. "Open up, Ma," I said louder. I stroked some more. "Open your mouth if you can." She snapped open her mouth in a large O and said, "Ah," breaking us all into laughter, herself included. It's the kind of joke she's played before. Some years ago, in the middle of a night in the hospital after my mother's first foot amputation, my father was drawing up a dose of insulin for her in the dark while she lay in a morphine-drenched sleep. He was being careful, as always, holding up the little bottle and syringe to the light, spilling in from the door, then swabbing a spot on her shoulder with alcohol on a cotton ball, then setting the bottle of insulin down on the nightstand gently, then turning the needle toward her skin and positioning his hand so he'd be able to plunge the dose in smoothly. "Hurry up!" My dad and sister and I jumped, and he nearly dropped the needle. From somewhere unimaginably far away, the corner of my mom's mouth rose in a mischievous little smile. Scotland, late fall to Christmas Eve. People stand on the seawall, their backs to our cottage, and stare into the sea. Much as I love to look from this window at the unpeopled scene, weeds sprouting from between the cold stones, crab and lobster boats tied side by side, waves out past the harbor rising and tipping forward to crumble on the reef, much as I love its pure seascape, the view is somehow only right when it includes the back of someone atop that seawall and gazing out, a lone soul standing on the precipice, taking in everything to the Isle of May and the sea's horizon beyond, completes the drama. We are meant to be the world's audience. I don't think of you much, reader. You are a good, constant, quiet companion. But it's essential that you should be here. I imagine you on that seawall, your thoughts completely your own, your identity unknown to me. I've brought you here because the now sad, now ecstatic, now serene beauty of this world seems complete with you in it. I put you out there in the sea wind and cold sunshine, and make myself the one who brought you to it, so that I might participate, in this modest way, in the world I see, might make myself the usher who led you to it, so this life's mysterious beauty might be completed in you, its audience.
Thank you for listening to The Bookshelf on Spokane Public Radio. If you missed an episode, you can catch up online at spokanepublicradio.org or on the Bookshelf podcast. That marks the end of tonight's episode of The Desk on the Sea, written and read by Jonathan Johnson. The music for this episode is by Kerdwin and Greg Spatz. I'm Ben Reed.